There are stories, even for someone who tells them, reads them, and thinks about them all the time, that stick with you. Whether it's because the people at the center are so compelling, because the issue is so universal, or simply because someone is speaking about their own truth, you can't get them out of your mind. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. I'm off on a reporting trip this week, so we are bringing you some of those stories that linger, that stay in our minds here at the show, about a young woman who has built one of the hottest brands among millennials, about lives spent among the lobsters and how they're being changed by a warming earth, and an essay from the heart of Silicon Valley about work and what we value. Come share your thoughts with us on Marketplace.org, on Facebook, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. One of the things we do here is spend time with entrepreneurs to get a better sense of what developing and growing a business is like. Recently, we went to see Emily Weiss, the CEO and founder of the skincare and beauty company Glossier.
We are sitting in the Rihanna room at Glossier headquarters in Lower Manhattan. To our left is Beyonce. To our right is Madonna. Downstairs is Naomi.
So, yeah, they've got conference rooms named after female celebrities, an airy office filled with young people, and a brand, Glossier, that if you don't know about, your 20-year-old daughter probably does. Back in 2010, Weiss launched a beauty blog called Into the Gloss that became wildly popular. Then, 4 years later, came Glossier, a regimen of skincare basics aimed at young women with a kind of less is more philosophy. Glossier raised $8.4 million within 6 weeks of launching. And now, Weiss is rolling out the second phase of Glossier's products.
The three products that come in yet another pink bubble pouch are a concealer. It's called Stretch Concealer because it's very elastic and it kind of moves with you and doesn't settle into any fine lines. It gives you this really like beautiful dewy finish. Boy Brow, which is a grooming pomade for your eyebrows. So think of it like a brow gel, except it's not crunchy or flaky or sticky or shiny.
Okay.
And then our Generation G Sheer Matte Lipstick. So that's a lipstick that comes in four shades that give you kind of like a makeout mouth, sort of like blotted look. So it's not like a bold lip. It's really more like a French girl kind of like subtle stain.
Those products are part of Weiss's expanding business. To fund it, she recruited some of the venture capitalists behind startups like Warby Parker, Birchbox, and Instacart. I asked her about the transition from running a beauty blog to running a company.
The way that I met those investors is really through, I guess, just like the way anyone in New York meets anyone. It's just connections and like, you know, I knew someone's girlfriend and then I got a meeting and the first meeting led to a second meeting and one thing led to another.
There's something sort of telling in what you just said there. You knew someone's girlfriend. Was going to VCs to raise money. Were you the woman in the room?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. Totally. I mean, and that's like not a secret. We don't dance around that. I give people so much shade, like so the guys, and they laugh. I mean, it's very funny, you know, I try and kind of put things on them sometimes. Like I'm kind of like, oh, no, try this like lip balm. Come on. Or try this boy brow. I'm going to put it in your eyebrows right now at the table. And they all kind of get like a rise out of that. But, you know, I chose our partners the same way that I've chosen anyone that I've worked with over my, like, I guess, adult life, which is just who really believes what we believe and who's going to be a genuine, you know, partner, not just someone who wants to like make a quick buck or someone who doesn't understand the power of brand. And they have the same appreciation for the consumer that I think we do and that I've always had because I am her. I am the consumer. So the way that we do business is very much always looking at things through how is this going to feel to the customer? And we're brutally honest about that. And our investors keep us honest.
Beauty is a difficult industry in part because it is both aspirational and yet at the same time, particularly for young women, if it is too aspirational, you can be selling them something dangerous. I'm curious how you straddle that line. I mean, I went back and looked at your Into the Gloss wedding preparations. You went on a cleanse. You didn't eat dairy, gluten, sugar, alcohol, or coffee, which all of this
sure
sounds
didn't.
Terrible.
Yeah.
But someone might look at that and say, well, wait, what is the message that she's sending to a 17-year-old?
Totally. And I think anyone who knows me, and that means anyone who reads Into the Gloss and has read the post before, the post after, and even within that post itself, I have a green juice and I go on a cleanse for 21 days. And then next thing you know, I'm like, eating a cheeseburger, is that healthy? Like, probably not. Like, is it? But I think it's modern life. Like, it's modern.
But do you see what I'm getting at from a beauty context where you are, your brand is about sort of minimalism and health. And so I wonder how much time you spend thinking about this. Is like, how do we hit that sweet spot of
Glossier's about minimalism and health?
No?
No.
No? You don't think so?
No. I think it's about reflecting real life of a bunch of different women. And we talk about, I mean, for example, if you look on hashtag Glossier, within the first 30 seconds, you'll find a picture of a girl with a glass of wine masking in the bathtub. And she's like retoxing and detoxing at the same time. Because that's just, everyone aspires to be the best version of themselves, whatever that means. But at the same time, we're all human. It's just about understanding that, like, you know, we're all striving, but life is also fun. Like, don't take it too seriously.
When you look at where you are now, who do you want to be in 5 years? Are there CEOs or founders who you think, yeah, there are things from their life where I could take a little bit of that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I love brands, and I think there's a lot of talk lately about e-commerce, about digitally native brands, about all these things, but I think, you know, it's no secret that everything is going omni-channel, right? So maybe the pendulum swung the other way, where now brands start on the internet, and then they end up being everywhere, rather than starting everywhere and then selling on the internet.
A la Amazon.
Yeah, but I think that brands are brands, and that's never going to change. And in today's climate, I think our biggest enemy will be the churn rate of people's attention spans, right, to newness. And if you look at the fashion industry, that's something that is really it's almost like cannibalizing itself, because they're on this cycle now where they're launching like 6, you know, collections a year, and designers are having major burnout, and next thing you know, there's like 10 more because thanks to the internet, you can sell, you know, there can be, you know, so much newness. And so for me, I really have a lot of, you know, admiration for brands like Ralph Lauren, brands that really have built a lifestyle over 20 plus years that are still relevant. And you've got, you know, kids in the other side of the world wanting Ralph Lauren t-shirts, you know, just because they want to be a part of that. And for that to still be relevant, I mean, think of like, you know, for kids on the other side of the world not being like, mom, God, about Ralph Lauren is like really cool. And so I think we'd like to be a brand like that, a brand that is not a trend and is not defining a moment, but really transcends time and grows with women.
Emily Weiss, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now it's time to take the marketplace quiz. That's when we ask actors, musicians, writers, and other people in the spotlight to share their stories about work, money, and the lessons they've learned. Producer Raghu Manavalan has this week's guest.
Hi, I'm Samantha Bee. I host the show Full Frontal on TBS Mondays at 10:30.
In a next life, what would your career be?
In my next life, my career would probably be something in the world of food. I could theoretically see myself as a very artisanal farmer that really like plows by hand. I'm not even kidding. Or a chef, or someone who runs a restaurant, actually a small restaurant, a breakfast restaurant. I cook all the time. I cook all the time. It's really important to me. I shop for ingredients. It's very inconvenient. It's one of the most inconvenient things that can be your hobby, because I work a lot. So it's really hard to make time. It's hard to carve out time to get the good eggs at the farmer's market, but I do it. I'm exhausted. I'm exhausted.
I guess this leads me to my next question. What is the hardest part about your job that no one knows?
Oh, that's a great question. There's just a lot of kind of technical minutiae around doing this job, or at least around building a show up from zero. You know, you have to make the business cards, and you have to figure out who's sitting where in your office. There are kind of technical considerations. You have to build a set from scratch. I mean, it's not like we didn't work with someone. We absolutely did. But There's a lot of sort of decision making about things like color schemes and materials that go into the building of your set. And that's not really my world. So I actually was very challenged by having to make split second decisions about things that would make the physical makeup of the show over time that I'd have to live with for a really long time.
What is something you bought that you now completely regret buying?
I don't really regret anything that I've bought in recent memory. I do regret selling my house in Canada. We sold our house in Canada in 2006 or something like that, because it was obvious we weren't going to live in it anymore. But I feel like we should have held on to it because, you know, I could have put a parent in it or something like that. It was a great house. And so now when I go back to Toronto and I visit my family, sometimes I do a drive-by. I drive slowly up the street to see if they changed did the paint, or, you know, if they did anything to the deck. I completely regret selling my house in Canada.
What is your most prized possession?
We have one thing, which is a chandelier. We have a beautiful kind of wire chandelier with metal birds on it from France that my husband bought for us when we bought a house in Toronto, and we were so broke and it was so expensive. And he bought it because we loved it so much, and it was an amazing, and of course we still have it. We'll have it forever. It's really beautiful and I love it, but I do, when I really think about it, I think about who we were at that time and how much of a stretch it was for him to buy that for me.
When did you realize your current career could be an actual paying career?
I only realized that when I got hired to do it. I was working at an advertising agency at the time when I got hired by The Daily Show, so they rescued me from the real world. And that was probably the first time I went, oh, I could probably do this for a while. This could be sustained as long as they don't fire me. And then they didn't.
What is something everyone should own no matter the cost?
Is something that everyone should own no matter the cost? Well, I'm going to make this a specific woman thing. Sorry. Every woman should own a good bra no matter how much it costs. Even if you need to get that bra custom made, you should have a bra that fits you. It's so important. It's essential for happiness.
What advice do you wish someone gave you before you started your career?
Well, I think people gave me a lot of advice before I started my career, and I think a lot of that advice was, don't do that career. That's a terrible idea. So mostly people's advice. Thank goodness I didn't take it.
In this week's show, we're looking back at some of our favorite recent stories. Last June, just after the Brexit vote, I went to the northwestern British city of St. Helens. It voted heavily to leave the EU. I had a few pints at the pub with three friends who didn't all vote the same way, but all voted for the same reason.
I'm a working man, and I don't see how Europe as it is helping the working man in this country. I've voted out, not for me personally, but for my children and grandchildren, to be honest.
I voted in for my children and grandchildren.
When I was there, I also talked with the chief executive of the St. Helens Council, Mike Palin. He makes the local government run. We talked about what the Brexit vote could mean for the city. And now, with Brexit becoming closer to a reality for the UK, we recently called him back up to check in.
As with many areas in the UK, we're actually waiting to understand what Brexit will mean at the local level. So obviously the UK has not triggered Article 50, so we're not in the formal process of leaving the EU yet. So, and even when that gets triggered, it takes 2 years. So we're almost in a bit of a phony situation while we're waiting to find out what Brexit will actually mean for a place like St. Helens.
One of the things that you and I talked about when I was visiting St. Helens is how you, a trained economist, are trying to position the town now as a logistics hub. You know, you're kind of in between some highways, you're near rail yards, you're not that far from Liverpool. Has this affected those plans for you at all?
It's not. So the logistics market is a domestic market within the UK. So since you were last here, we have had a planning application for 400,000 square foot approved through council, and we've had another planning application for 1.4 million square foot approved through council. Now, that one is subject to the national government having to offer a view, but since you were here, those schemes have come through. So we've got close to 2 million square foot approved through planning, and currently under consultation, two developers are bringing forward between them another 2.9 million square foot. So we've not seen an impact on that sector in any way, shape or form.
So square foot for what, for warehouses?
Primarily for warehouses. So these are a large distribution complexes, primarily for the changing nature of retail. So people in the UK will continue to consume retail goods, and these warehouses will be emerging out of the ground to respond to that changing retail market and the changed context in the UK, and the fact that the Port of Liverpool will treble its capacity over the next few years.
Liverpool is an international port, and I guess one question I have is, does that change things if we sort of move down the road with Article 50 triggered? Does that change the economy for you if things are not moving in and out of Western Europe through Liverpool, but rather just to the UK market?
And that's what we're waiting to see the implications and to actually get a better understanding of what it means for businesses that trade internationally. So within St. Helens, we've got a number of large manufacturers, and they're in almost a wait-and-see mode just to try and understand what the implications will be, both in terms of the free movement of labour, but also the free movement of goods and services throughout Western Europe. So one of our large manufacturers supplies into the European automotive industry, not just the British automotive industry. So, you know, they're waiting to see what happens over the next 18 months or so.
Oh, yeah, they make like a little glass part, right?
They do. They make a glass cord that you can find almost in almost all motor vehicles manufactured in Europe. That component part features in the motor vehicle. So for them, it's very important that they have access to European markets. But they're also a Japanese-owned company, so they've got a very international perspective on what Brexit may mean.
You know, you are in an area that was really not far from the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution.
We'd argue we were the birthplace. So we have the first, the oldest industrial canal in Britain, and Britain being the home of the Industrial Revolution. And we were the rocket, which was the first train, was the rocket trials where they were tested, also took place in St. Helens. So we do argue we were the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution.
Well, how would you describe your economy to outsiders now, you know, who are listening to you and me chat on the phone?
I'd argue that it's been, we've suffered from deindustrialization, as many areas of the United States has, but we've been resilient through that period. So the manufacturing businesses we've got today don't employ anywhere near as many people, but they're still highly productive. We have new sectors emerging like logistics. We're beginning to see a series of digital businesses develop within the borough. So it's a positive future in terms of our economy, primarily because of where we're located. There's 35 million people within a few hours' drive of St. Helens, and that's a large market that business will want to access.
I went to the pub, the Glass House, when I was there and chatted with three men who lived in St. Helens, had all their lives. Two voted to stay, one voted to leave the EU. And every single one of them had children who had left St. Helens. And I guess my question for you is, how do you keep your area vibrant if young people are leaving, and young people, as the numbers in the Brexit vote show, think of themselves as European, not just UK citizens?
I think the challenge for us is to promote and present a positive future to those young people. So you can do a university degree in St. Helens. There are red brick universities, as we call them in the UK, which are the more prestigious universities. There's Manchester and Liverpool, not very far away from here. So those opportunities in terms of training and education exist within the borough. But also, if you think of a modern manufacturing business or a modern logistics business, there are lots of opportunities in those industries that don't necessarily need a university qualification and that present a positive future for people. So as these sectors become active within St. Helens, we do need to promote them better to young people to encourage them to stay in the town.
Mike Palin, Chief Executive of the St. Helens Council, thank you so much for talking with me.
Nice to speak to you again.
Critic Ryan Sutton from the website Eater recently wrote the definitive ranking of fast food chicken nuggets. I'm going to read from it. Quote, "The nugget is a gateway drug, a young child's unwitting indoctrination into the corporate culinary industrial complex." Ryan wrote that a chicken nugget is not a chicken tender. So what is it?
A chicken nugget is slightly more complicated than a piece of chicken that's simply battered and fried. You know, when you think of a chicken tender, which is how a lot of us interact with fried chicken these days, we think of a piece of breast meat, and that's it. Maybe a little bit of seasoning, maybe a little bit of breading. It's pure product, for lack of a better term. When you think of a chicken nugget, you think more manipulated food. You think more processed food. The simplest way to break it down is a chicken tender is probably something you can usually make at home, a little bit of effort. A chicken nugget is something that most people would not make at home. And that's why it's so good to eat it out at a delicious fast food establishment.
There is also something, I guess, about a chicken nugget that feels like a quintessentially American product. I mean, that's why we have you on a business show and a plate of chicken nuggets in front of us. But why do you think that is?
Gosh, I don't know. If you want to get truly philosophical about it, you think of old America, you think of manufacturing. The chicken nugget is not necessarily, you know, gastronomy the way it is manifested today, you know, by, you know, celebrity chefs with artisanal products who cut things with their hand, manipulate it minimally, and then cook it or fry it and serve it beautifully. A chicken nugget is part of the larger food industrial complex. It's a quintessentially American product to me because it has been manipulated. It has been taken from its natural state, and it has been transformed.
Why did you decide to rate chicken nuggets? Like, what was the moment where that was like, oh, yeah, that seems like a good idea?
Well, good question. Probably the catalyst for me to review chicken nuggets on this particular month was, I think one of my editors told me that Taco Bell was making chicken nuggets in the shape of a tortilla chip or in the shape of a nacho. And I thought, well, that sounds tasty, or at least that sounds interesting.
Yeah.
And of course, I tried to find the tortilla chip chicken nugget. I couldn't, because it's being test marketed in areas of the country where there is a lower density full-time food riders. There's probably a reason for that. And I decided, well, let me just review all the other chicken nuggets and put things in perspective.
Okay, who won?
Wendy's won.
Not McDonald's.
Not McDonald's. McDonald's, some would argue, has the cleanest flavor. That came in second place for me.
Didn't you describe it as like eating a golden retriever?
It's like eating a golden lab because it's so beautifully blonde. You know, chicken in its natural form has both a clean flavor and a little bit of a funky flavor, especially if you have some skin in there. McDonald's or any other chicken nugget is more of an example of chicken acting as more of a neutral flavor, a conduit for other flavors. The chicken nugget is probably best described as chicken pretending to be tofu, which is why I would argue that if you could make any food vegan or vegetarian in the next few years on a mass scale, it wouldn't be the worst thing if you made a chicken nugget vegan or vegetarian, because you're not tasting the meat in the first place. And if you can save a few hundred thousand or million animals from getting slaughtered in the first place, why not do it and serve everyone tofu nuggets? And you know what? Probably wouldn't be able to tell the difference when you tried it.
Okay, I know Wendy's one. So we have in front of us McDonald's chicken nuggets, Wendy's chicken nuggets, and then we may never get the chicken nugget smell out of this studio. However, I'm going to reach across the table. We have a plate of chicken nuggets in front of us.
Try plain Wendy's, okay. Which I find to be the juiciest.
This is shaped like, sort of like the state of Idaho. Okay.
This one
that tastes
like
a little bit more like fried chicken, like actual fried chicken.
Fair enough. And it has, more than McDonald's, Wendy's has that brilliant bounciness.
Yeah, it's definitely bouncy.
It's like eating the chicken version of a dense marshmallow.
What has the response been? Have people been yelling at you on the internet?
Well, of course. You know, it's funny. I'm a professional food critic. I've been doing this for over a decade. And I can say reasonably nasty things about extremely high-profile restaurants in New York where dinner for two can easily cost over $800. And I'll have sometimes reasonably few comments in those pieces. But the second you start talking trash about someone's fast food chain, whoa, you better hide out for a while, because people have serious opinions, because fast food is the type of food that people grow up with. And I think more importantly, for a lot of people of many different income brackets, this is how they primarily interact with food outside of the home. It's a place for them to go quickly, eat food, and leave.
And it's cheap.
And I think that's one of the important things about food criticism, if we're going to continue to exist and for the next decade as journalism downsizes, is to simply be more ecumenical in our criticism. Because if film criticism can regularly have Hollywood movies as a steady dose of their diet, arguably, food critics can do the same with the Hollywood of their own industry.
Ryan Sutton is the chief food critic for Eater New York. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
I'm going to go drink like a gallon of water now.
You should. It's a lot of salt in there.
And now for a look at a food that's just a little, okay, I'm fine, a lot different from chicken nuggets. We're going to go to Rhode Island, specifically the docks at Newport Harbor. That's where a group of lobstermen spoke to Marketplace's Andy Euler about their jobs, the industry, and how both are transforming as the ocean gets warmer.
I'm John Walker.
Right now we're selling crabs, weighing them and selling them. You know, it's a tough business. The real problem with the business is poor management.
135.
Well, it used to be on the fisherman's end. There were a lot of poor fishing practices in the past, a lot of overfishing, too many people out there. They used to think there's more fish in the ocean than have ever been taken out of it, and they'll never go away. I mean, everybody's not so close-minded now. They know better. It is exhaustible, and it has its cycles, like things that come and go, and, you know, climate change and everything. There's definitely, you know, a little less of certain species around than there used to be. However, the way they're managing the species is counterproductive for us. How are you managing something if they tell you you can only keep 50 pounds of it, but your net comes up with 2,000 pounds, and you have to throw, you know, 1,950 pounds of dead stuff overboard? How are you helping to maintain a resource like that? I fish crab, I have a little bit of lobster allocation, and I work on fin fish, and I just started conch fishing. I've only been in business myself for 4 years. I came into it with little experience, so it's been tough for me to get started. Some of these guys, like that guy over there, he's been on boats since he was like 10 years old.
Paul Roussel. I've been doing it for 40 years. Yes, I've seen a huge change, and they send people out to do all this kind of research, and I hate to say it, but they're almost like ham and eggs because they're not really doing their job right, and then the government is basing rules on their research, and they're just absolutely not doing it right. I believe that people are going to be selling out, yes, and that has been happening. And I see a lot less lobsters. Hopefully they'll replenish. The stocks will replenish just through Mother Nature. I really hope that's what's going to happen. And it may happen very much because we don't see what's below the surface here. We don't really know what's going on below the surface.
Mother Nature always has its ups and downs. And it was all right until the government got involved with regulations that don't make sense. Right here, can't see it. We're obviously on a radio. This hole in the lobster pot was made to let the babies out, the short lobsters, the small lobsters out. In 2004, the government raised that hole to 2 inches. 40 to 70% of the legal lobsters get away at any given time. Almost every business on this dock could hire another man and employ people if they didn't have that. Everybody's working on the edge of not making it. People are working alone. People are starving because of that hole. What business can survive? 40 to 70%.
Ralph Jackson. From here, born and raised. We were on our own for years. There's no OSHA here or nothing like that. So we were fairly independent. And now we're paying the price for it because they don't subsidize us, you know? That's just the way it is. So don't become a lobsterman.
Is there any way to make it more sustainable, do you feel like, from your end?
Patience. Things do come back. You've seen them rebuild rivers and, you know. So that's the same with this. They'll come back sooner or later. Hopefully, you know. Maybe not here in this bay like it was. They didn't come back in New York. They didn't come back in Boston. But they'll come back. Yeah. Maybe 10 years from now, lobster will be a great industry. Who knows? I'm going to go down there and tie these pots up.
In this episode, we've been listening to some of our favorite stories. We talk a lot on this show about technology, what tech companies are doing and making, and how they influence our lives. But we don't often hear about what it feels like to live and work in the Silicon Valley bubble. There is a remarkable essay, though, that details that experience. Anna Weiner wrote it in 2016 for N+1 magazine. In it, she talks about her time at a startup, and it got a lot of attention in the tech community. We asked her to come on and read a little bit of it. Here she is.
Morale is down. We are making plenty of money, but the office is teeming with salespeople, well-groomed social animals with good posture and dress shoes, men who chuckle and smooth their hair back when they can't connect to our VPN. Their corner of the office is loud. Their desks are scattered with freebies from other startups, stickers and koozies and flash drives. We escape for drinks and fret about our company culture. Our culture is dying, we say gravely, apocalyptic prophets all. What should we do about the culture? It's not just the salespeople, of course. It's never just the salespeople. Our culture has been splintering for months. Members of our core team have been shepherded into conference rooms by top-level executives who proceed to question our loyalty. They've noticed the sea change. They've noticed we don't seem as invested. We don't stick around for in-office happy hour anymore. We don't take new hires out for lunch on the company card. We're not hitting our KPIs. We're not serious about the OKRs. People keep using the word paranoid. Our primary investor has funded a direct competitor. This is what investors do, but it feels personal. Daddy still loves us, but he loves us less. We get ourselves out of the office and into a bar. We have more in common than our grievances, but we kick off by speculating about our job security, complaining about the bureaucratic double downs, casting blame for blocks and poor product decisions. We talk about our IPO like it's the deus ex machina coming down from on high to save us. Like it's an inevitability, like our stock options will lift us out of our existential dread, away from the collective anxiety that ebbs and flows. Realistically, we know it could be years before an IPO, if there's an IPO at all. We know in our hearts that money is a salve, not a solution. Still, we are hopeful. We reassure ourselves and one another that this is just a phase. Every startup has its growing pains. Eventually, we are drunk enough to change the subject, to remember our more private selves. The people we are on weekends, the people we were for years. Work has wedged its way into our identities, and the only way to maintain sanity is to maintain that we are the company. The company is us. Whenever we see a stranger at the gym wearing a t-shirt with our logo on it, whenever we are mentioned on social media or on a client's blog, whenever we get a positive support ticket, we share it in the company chat room and we're proud, genuinely proud. But we see now that we've been swimming in the Kool-Aid and we're coming up for air. We were lucky and in thrall, and now we are bureaucrats, punching at our computers, making other people, some kids, unfathomably rich. We throw our dead cigarettes on the sidewalk and grind them out under our toes. Phones are opened and taxis summoned. We gulp the dregs of our beers as cartoon cars approach on screen. 8 hours later, we'll be back in the office, slurping down coffee, running out for congealed breakfast sandwiches, tweaking mediocre scripts and writing half-hearted emails, throwing weary and knowing glances across the table. I skim recruiter emails and job listings like horoscopes, skidding down to the perks. Competitive salary, dental and vision, 401k, free gym membership, catered lunch, bike storage, ski trips to Tahoe, offsites to Napa, summits in Vegas, beer on tap, craft beer on tap, kombucha on tap, wine tastings, whiskey Wednesdays, open bar Fridays, massage on site, yoga on site, pool table, ping pong robot, ball pit, game night, movie night, go-kart, zip line. Job listings are an excellent place to get sprayed with HR's idea of fun and a 23-year-old's idea of work-life balance. Sometimes I forget I'm not applying to summer camp. Customize setup, design your ultimate workstation with the latest hardware, change the world around you, help humanity thrive by enabling next. We work hard, we laugh hard, we give great high fives. We have engineers and top coders, top 20. We're not just another social web app. We're not just another project management tool. We're not just another payment processor. I get a haircut and start exploring.
For more on her story, Uncanny Valley, and her experiences in the tech world, we've got Anna here. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much, Lizzie.
You know, when I first read this, I thought it was fiction, but it's not?
It is fictionalized. I'm curious why you thought it was fiction.
I guess because it almost felt too real to be real, if that makes any sense. So many of these details, maybe it's because I live on the East Coast and I'm not in the tech world, but I thought, oh my God, that must be exaggerated and attenuated to make this startup world seem even crazier than it is.
I wish that were the case. I think that there are instances where things are played down a little bit.
Like, what do you mean?
I heard that feedback specifically from women who said that they thought the piece was pretty gentle with regard to women in tech and sexism.
Yeah, you make the point about sexism, but it doesn't seem to overwhelm a lot of the other stuff in the tech industry. I mean, how much of that did you feel on an everyday basis?
I think that there are two varieties of sexism that I encountered. The first was the sort of cultural sexism in the office. Everyone has a story about a coworker who gets a little too friendly. And then the version that's a little bit more subtle but definitely dangerous, which is the sexism that inhibits women from moving up in their careers.
Why did you decide to write this?
People who are not in this world don't understand what it is. And I think people are curious, but the mainstream representations of Silicon Valley do it sort of a disservice. I've read very little that makes this place seem human, while also, you know, speaking to the elements that deserve to be criticized and the elements that deserve to be celebrated. So I was trying to operate in that space.
Do you like working in tech?
I really do. I do still work in the tech industry. I work at another software company. I think that it is the industry that is best poised for social change. The industry I worked in before tech was the book publishing industry, which I have tremendous fondness for. But I was sort of looking around and not seeing a career path that was very exciting to me or that I thought I would be very good at. And I also was seeing a lot of my peers sort of burn out or look at their own career paths and say, this seems unsustainable financially, or I don't want to be answering someone else's phone for 7 years. The tech industry is sort of the foil for that. People are given a lot of agency here often at a very young age. I'm sounding like a booster. I'm actually very cynical about technology, but I do think that there is something to be said for this new style of work.
Well, I finished this piece, and to me, I came away feeling profoundly sad. And I wonder how that strikes you.
Well, I'm sorry that it made you profoundly sad. I've seen a lot of people say that it was depressing. I think that this is a document of a year and a half of my life where I was profoundly sad, and it was a really empty 18 months of my life. And I didn't really know that until I left. Work and identity really do become fused for a lot of people, and they did for me. And
trying to find existential value in work is a really tricky gamble. I think some people do it. And for me, I'd moved across the country. I didn't know very many people out here. And I was giving everything to a job that I didn't really feel was giving back.
Anna Wiener, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your office is anything like our office, someone is probably sneezing, spreading that cold that's been going around. It seems like when one person at work gets sick, it's only a matter of time before everyone does. One potential reason why is the actual office. Most of the buildings we work in are completely sealed off from the outside world. That helps save on heating and cooling costs, but it can also mean that tiny little microorganisms are just endlessly circulating around you. To discuss the office microbiome, we've got Zoe Schlanger, science contributor at Wired, who wrote about this. I asked her if we're basically just sitting in a big bowl of germs.
Absolutely. The Great. Second you walk into your office or literally any room, you're just bathed in microbes that aren't yours continuously.
Can you tell me what a microbiome is? Because that's something that I feel like gets tossed around a lot. I don't exactly know what it means.
Yeah, this past year we've heard so much hype about the human microbiome, which is all of the tiny little single-celled creatures that live in your gut, in your genitals, in your mouth, all over your skin. And it turns out they play a huge role in our health, and we're still trying to figure out what it is. It's basically an alien planet right now to scientists. We're only understanding small aspects of how it affects your immune system and which microbes are good and which are bad. But the microbiome, it turns out, extends way beyond your body. We walk around in a cloud of microbes every day, and they're in your building, too. Every surface you touch, every cubic foot of air you breathe in, it's full of these germs.
How is your office microbiome different than the one in your house, let's say?
Typically, it'll have a lot more human microbes swimming around because you don't have as many people in your house. But also, they're designed, typically, if you work in an office building with many floors, the ventilation is determining how many microbes and which microbes you're around in. So it'll be a higher content of artificial microbes than it would be in your house, typically.
So you and I are actually sitting under a vent in this studio that's coming down from another floor. What is falling on us that we can't see?
Probably the microbes of whoever is in the office above you. Have you ever gone to check them out and see how healthy they look?
I guess we should do that.
But also just anything else that's been sitting in the ducts, for example, or any of the dust that's just been accumulating. Typically, if you come into your office on a Monday, the ventilation system's been off all weekend, and you're probably getting a lot more artificial dust that you're breathing in coming in through these vents.
So if someone is listening to this right now, they want to know, what is this doing to me?
The interesting part is that we know very little. This is the first year, really, that researchers are trying to determine what is happening and what these things might be doing to us. There's a million experiments going on right now, papers coming out probably next year that'll help us understand things like, if you touch your water cooler, how many microbes are actually crawling into your own microbiome and transferring? We don't know that yet. Things like, if your windows don't open in your office, are you more likely to get sick because you're not intermingling with some of the beneficial outdoor microbes as much? All things we don't know that are hugely affecting our health, especially in places like hospitals.
So if they are affecting our health, but we're sort of still trying to understand that, are there things you can do now to avoid getting sick?
I think opening a window, if you can. Now, this is always a tricky thing because there's lots and lots of research that says children, for example, who grow up in farms where they're constantly contacting animals and they have contact with dirt have a much lower rate of immune disorders or things like asthma. And so researchers are tentatively saying more interaction with outside air is better. But then you have to wonder, is there a truck idling outside your window?
Right.
We don't know.
Like if you and I were to walk out of the studio and throw open a window onto Third Avenue, what would that be, good, bad? Do we know?
It's completely up in the air right now. My guess would be probably not the greatest. I mean, all the city buses and everything. But maybe better than just constantly breathing in the recirculating air, which is a very new phenomena. Humans have only been living in these tight buildings for maybe the last two generations at most. So we really don't know what it means to live in a sealed environment.
When we think about a sealed environment and when we think about our microbiome, are there things that this research is informing in the way design works and people use building materials and all the stuff that could change for the next generation or a few generations from now?
Absolutely. I think we're going to see this come up a lot more in the next few years. There's actually a startup in San Francisco that's still in stealth mode, so they won't let me talk about them. But they're specifically figuring out how to design offices to circulate microbes in such a way that might help the health of the people who live or work in the office. People are really trying to figure out how to be intentional about design, how to design vents in a certain way, how to somehow bring in beneficial outdoor microbes, how to position houseplants so that their beneficial microbes are circulating more. That is one thing you can do for your health. Have more plants.
Have more plants. Okay, good. We have seen big trends in office design rise and fall. People had offices with doors that closed. Then open plan offices came into vogue. Then certain kinds of lighting came into vogue. Do you think it's possible that thinking about the physical health of an office is the next thing that architects and designers are going to be working with?
I think absolutely. There's been a trend towards making our buildings more sealed off from the outside because it's more energy efficient. So as all these cities are trying to be more wary of climate change, use less energy, they're sealing offices off more, which hypothetically could be bad for our health. We don't quite have those conclusions yet. But now that we're starting to understand that, I think people will be trying to restructure offices so that they have more flow and can be better for one's health.
What are the top few things that scientists are studying to say, hey, like, this might not be a great idea?
So there's this new trend of putting antimicrobial agents into house paint and linoleum flooring and all kinds of things you'd use as building materials. And researchers are just starting to be like, hold on a minute. Why are we putting things that will generate potentially more antibiotic-resistant genes in our dust that we're all breathing in every day? So there's this big debate now, like building materials kind of very unregulated. No one's really looking out for it. And all these paints that put antimicrobials in them are now labeling themselves as better for your health, but we really have no idea whether or not that's true, and people are suggesting it might be the opposite.
This seems to sort of mirror the debate about whether you use antibacterial soap on your hands.
Exactly. The FDA banned triclosan this year, which is one of the big antimicrobial agents in soap, because they couldn't find any conclusions that said they actually improved one's health, and there's too many things that are suggesting it could disrupt our hormone cycles or do other slightly malicious things to our health. And now nobody's doing anything about it in walling, for example. There's no regulations on that.
So if I get to the end of a long week in the office, should I just go outside and roll around in the dirt?
I think that'd be a great idea. Or just stick your face in your puppy. If you have one, or your cat, they'll transfer lots of beneficial microbes your way, apparently.
Zoe Schlanger is a science contributor at Wired Magazine. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Over the past year, we've talked with people all over the country to get a sense of how the economy feels to them. It's part of our My Economy series. Today, a story from a woman working multiple jobs to make ends meet.
My name is Tammy Schultz. I'm 46 years old, and I work at the University of Tennessee here in Knoxville, Tennessee. I do like what I do. I clean the offices. I get the trash. I dust. I clean off the table, buff up a floor or something. I clean the elevators, sweep the steps, shampoo some carpet, clean the railings off, and I bring home anywhere from $500 to $600 every 2 weeks. To juggle my bills around. A lot of things go undone that, I mean, I just have to prioritize. Like maintenance on my car right now. It's overdue for 2 months. And right now I just don't have the money. I have to pay the bills first. I have little for food. I don't go out. I don't do anything. Things are getting higher and higher, and the cost of living is getting higher and higher. Just for someone to be able to make ends meet and have a family, you know, they need to be paid more money. Right now I make $10.55 an hour. Possibly a good range of being paid to me would be anywhere from like $16 an hour to $22 an hour. At that point, I think I could pay my bills, not live lavishly, but, you know, at least live with my head above water, not have to worry about who am I going to pay this month, you know, is the bills going to be paid on time, are they not?
And that's our show for this week. Visit us anytime at marketplace.org, our Facebook page, or hit us up on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills, Haley Hirschman, and Raghu Manavalan. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Bill Lance is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Satara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.